Spirit Mornings and welcome. You're with Bruce McGregor and
Chris McGregor.
Today joined again by Mike Aquilina, author of The Mass of the Early Christians and several other books on the early church, all published through our Sunday Visitor. Mike, of course, Vice President of the St. Paul Center for Biblical Theology. And we do want to encourage all of you to visit that website often, www.salvationhistory.com. Mike is with us today because we are going to discuss the very early Roman martyrs. Mike, good morning. Welcome to the program.
Good morning, Bruce. Good morning, Chris.
Oh, it's always a joy to have you back with us, Mike. People in our audience are always at, when's Mike Aquilina going to be on again? You know, we always tell them, look for the feast day of one of the church fathers. But today you're with us on a very important occasion. And I don't think I ever had a sense of who the Roman martyrs were until I actually saw the movie Quo Vadis, where you got a sense of those early Christians who would step up and witness to the world.
Right, right. Well, the Roman martyrs came so early in the game before most of the people we know as the church fathers that they died in 64 A.D., so we're going back very early in the life of the church.
Right.
Well, you're such a great storyteller. Why don't you tell this story for us?
Well, you know, at that time, the emperor was Nero, and Nero is notorious. Everybody knows his name.
Mm-hmm.
He's the guy who fiddled while Rome burned. Well, he did likely recite his poems. That's the legend. He fiddled while Rome burned. And Rome did burn, and Nero supposedly recited his poems while playing on a lute, while he watched Rome burn. He was very happy to see it go. He wanted to do some urban renewal. And it seems likely most of the early historians, most of the Roman historians, believed that Nero himself had the fire set. Because he wanted to clear away the slums and build himself what he called, what he did build and called his golden house. And the golden house has just been excavated recently, remarkably intact with its artwork, and it's sumptuous. And the reason it's remarkably intact is because Nero was so hated by the Romans during his lifetime that as soon as he was dead, they just wanted to bury the house. It was the symbol of Nero, and they just wanted to put Nero in their past. And you have to understand, Nero was as sick as a human being can be. If you imagine all the worst serial killers you've heard about, okay, the most sadistic serial killers you've heard about, the most twisted people, imagine them with this kind of ultimate power over a worldwide empire. That's Nero. He was loathed for this. He was he fancied himself an artist, and everything he did was show business. But he was very paranoid, and he always thought people were out to get him, and probably for good reason.
They probably were.
Sure. I mean, you think about Nero. Nero was a guy who killed his mother. He killed his wife by kicking her to death while she was pregnant with his unborn child. You know, he was a sick ticket. He was a really sick ticket, and he was universally loathed, and a lot of people had reason to be out for him. But if he did set this fire, and it seems that he did, and it seemed that immediately that was the gossip in Rome, and he was very fearful for his life. He was afraid of being overthrown because he done this, or at least a lot of people were saying that he did it, and so he had to find a scapegoat. And here were this upstart cult, this church, this Jewish sect, so it already had foreign associations. And not only that, but it was this religion that took exception to the sexual morality of the vast majority of Romans. These were the killjoys. These were the people who were telling you that what you were doing was wrong. So a lot of people, you know, probably were somewhat in sympathy with the persecution of the Christians if they could get one going. And Nero, you know, said he had a few of the Christians tortured until they were almost crazy and they could admit to anything. And they did. You know, they admitted to, you know, whatever role in this. But Nero knew that none of this would ever stand up in court. And the Romans were, for all of their faults, they were a people devoted to the law and to legal precedent. So Nero didn't have them charged with arson or treason or conspiracy or anything like that. He charged them with this kind of vague thing called hatred of humanity.
Wow.
Mostly because of their view on sin, you know, original sin, and on sexual morality. If all humans are living this way, with this kind of depraved lust, like Nero was living, to one degree or another, you know, Rome was functioning this way, well, then it's hatred of humanity to say that the people are wrong. So Nero did have them kind of convicted on these trumped-up charges, condemned to death, we're lucky because we don't know the names of any of the first round of Roman martyrs.
Mm-hmm.
We don't know any of their names. But we know what happened to them because it was preserved for us by a Roman historian, a pagan Roman historian of the time, who hated Christians.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
He had contempt for Christians, but you know, he had to have some grudging admiration and sympathy for this first round of martyrs. And he is the one who wrote their story. And I can read a little bit from him if you want me to.
That'd be great.
Sure.
This is from Tacitus. And he says, "Mockery of every sort was added to their deaths. Covered with the skins of beasts, they were torn by dogs and perished, or were nailed to crosses, or were doomed to the flames. They served as torches to light up the night when daylight failed." Nero had thrown open the gardens for the spectacle and was exhibiting a show in the circus while he mingled with the people in the dress of a charioteer or drove about in a chariot. Hence, even for criminals who deserved extreme and exemplary punishment, there arose a feeling of compassion, for it was not, as it seemed, for the public good, but to glut one man's cruelty that they were being punished.
Mm.
So you see, it was all show business for Nero.
Right.
You know, the emperors of that time had to provide these spectacles for the people to keep them amused. And the emperors tried to undo their predecessors all the time. So this was Nero's way of throwing a party, you know, to make human torches out of the Christians, or to dress them up like animals and send them in to battle other animals. He thought up the sickest and cruelest deaths for them. He made them public spectacles. It was a terrible thing.
Wow.
You wonder how the Roman people could enter into this kind of spectacle, seeing all this. But I would imagine that this fire, which it would have had taken hundreds, if not thousands, of lives,
yes,
would have been an event that just their anger, and these were scapegoats.
Right. And you know, as you said, that the fire, you have to think, there was no technology to battle the blaze.
Mm-hmm.
And it burned for something like a week.
Wow.
It did take a lot of lives, and the tenements didn't have fire escapes. There was no way. If your building started to go up, you were dead.
Yeah.
So there was no way to escape. To a certain extent, this was business as usual in Rome. There were always bloody spectacles. Nero is kind of an extreme example, and he took things way out there. But this was business as usual in pagan Rome. But you see that even a pagan like Tacitus recoils in horror from it, that there's something wrong here. But the problem, legally, was that Nero had established a legal precedent for persecuting Christians.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And it was always that precedent that later emperors and governors and other Roman officials would appeal to when they initiated new persecutions.
Right. And as you pointed out, too, Mike, that once this kind of became the order of the day, then the common Romans, gangs and every... It was like open season, wasn't it?
It was. It was. And you could get off easily if you had a riot against Christians or something like that. It's something that you could do and know you were going to get away with.
So for the early Christians, they were essentially had to go underground.
Yes, and they did. You know, that they had these house churches, and they would meet in secret for the most part. As the church grew, that became more and more difficult. But still, even then, you have to think that ordinary Christians, there was no such thing as a Catholic in name only. If
mm-hmm.
you were a Christian, you had to be ready to die for it. You had to be willing to die for it. And you, in a certain extent, you had to rehearse your martyrdom because there was a good chance that it might be coming your way. So they had to prepare themselves for this, and we know that from the earliest days they did. And they did it in a certain way that we even know today. And it's the way that we prepare ourselves for self-giving today. And that's by the Mass.
Mm-hmm.
The interesting thing is that in the early church, Christians often associated martyrdom with the Eucharist. They considered it the same kind of self-giving, the total gift of self, as Jesus gives in the Eucharist. Jesus himself associated the Eucharist with his death. This is my body. This is my blood poured out. They saw that their participation in the Eucharist as their participation in his death, and they had to be willing to imitate him, to live his life to the very end if they were called to do so. We see this even in the book of Revelation, where St. John says, "In heaven he saw under the altar the souls of those who had been slain for the word of God and for the witness they had borne." So there they were under the altar of sacrifice.
Mm-hmm.
And then on, we find this word, the sacrifice, used in the Didache and all of the early documents of the Church to describe the Mass. And St. Paul, too, describes his own impending martyrdom in these sacrificial terms. He says he's like a libation about to be poured out. Then we hear Ignatius of Antioch echoing those same terms, because he says, you know, grant me nothing more than that I be poured out to God while an altar is still ready. Ignatius is a libation, just like Paul was. And they saw, all of them saw their martyrdom in Eucharistic terms. And it's really no different today. Pope Benedict has talked about this. He has a great passage in a book that recently came out from Ignatius Press called Pilgrim Fellowship of Faith, where he talks about martyrdom as a way in which the Christian can become a Eucharist. So we're talking about the same thing. When Pope Benedict wants to talk about this, where does he go? He goes back to the Fathers. Right. He goes back to the early Church. And he brings up that passage from Philippians where Paul says he's to be poured out like a libation. And he says, the witness of the apostle's death is liturgical in character. It is a matter of his life being spilled out as a sacrificial gift, of his letting himself be spilled out for men. What happens in this is a becoming one with the self-giving of Jesus Christ, with his great act of love, which is as such the true worship of God. And this is what we're all called to. We're called to give ourselves poured out to the dregs. And that's what we do in the Eucharist, and we have to be ready to do in martyrdom. I guess I've come a long way from the martyrs of Rome.
Oh, but, I don't think so.
But it's not such a long way, because these are the people, when we go to Mass, we're still in communion with them. We're still in communion with these saints and with the Eucharist that they celebrated. It's all the one sacrifice of Jesus Christ.
You know, when you talk about their willingness to make that sacrifice and that connection to the sacrifice of Christ, really, I think I have to go back to some of our sacraments when we talk about the priesthood. I was recalling the other day when Pope Leo, I think it was, at the turn of the 20th century, who talked about how the priesthood in the Catholic Church is different than, say, the priesthood of maybe the Episcopal Church, the Anglican Church, because we still have an element of sacrifice that's present in that Eucharistic celebration, unlike in other areas where it's a memorial or a communal type of meal.
That's right. And so the priest is not only talking about Jesus. The priest is Jesus. He's configured to Jesus with the special sacramental character, we say. And in the ordination, right, that's symbolized by his laying down his life.
Mm-hmm.
He prostrates himself on the floor of the cathedral or wherever it is that he's ordained. And
right.
It's a very striking image of martyrdom. The priest is preparing himself for martyrdom by that participation in Christ's life. And this is, again, this is something we're all participating in. It's not as dramatic an image when we go to communion every Sunday, but it's still fairly dramatic, and we shouldn't let it grow old on us. This is the way the Roman martyrs prepared for their martyrdom, by going to Mass every Sunday, by receiving Holy Communion every day in some instances, I'm sure whenever they could,
right.
By telling themselves again and again, I'm pouring my life out. We continue that outpouring of our life by living lives of charity with one another, for our families, by living sacrificially as we give to our children or to our parents as they grow older. All of these things that we're doing, we're pouring out our lives for the sake of another person. And that's what Jesus did on the cross. That's what Jesus did in the first Mass at the Last Supper, and that's what we participate in at every single Mass ever since then. He pours out his life, we pour out ours, and they're mingled together.
It's amazing that in that understanding of Eucharist, in the formation of those who would become those Christians who would be willing to lay down their lives like that to witness and to carry on that faith. What is it that they knew that we don't know now, that where, you know, the largest Christian denomination in the United States is Roman Catholicism, and the third group are non-practicing Catholics? Or even the Protestant denominations, where there were just, you know, a couple in the beginning, now there's 20,000 different denominations.
Sure.
I mean, what is it that they would lay down their lives, and yet when we don't like it, well, I'm going to go somewhere else?
Well, I think there are two things that we've forgotten. And that the first thing is that Christianity costs something. And then there's step two.
Mm-hmm.
Christianity costs everything.
Mm-hmm.
Everything. We have to deny ourselves. So we have to even give ourselves. We have to, you know, do what St. Paul said and pour ourselves out like a libation. We have to lose ourselves. But often what we do when we accept Christianity or when we say, yeah, I'm a Christian, there's often a but. Yeah, I'm a Christian, but I don't buy into all that stuff about whatever, birth control or divorce or abortion or any number of these things where we really have to sign on and we really have to live sacrificially. We really have to live charitably. We really have to give ourselves. We really have to sacrifice ourselves. And it's not as if martyrdom is a remote possibility. They say that in the 20th century, more Christians died as martyrs than in all the other centuries combined.
That's right.
So many more than in the Roman Empire. Under Nazi Germany and Communist China and Communist Russia, the Soviet Union, and in Africa.
Mm-hmm.
In the 20th century, many, many, many of our Christian brothers came to understand that this is going to cost us everything. But if we're holding back now and saying, well, I'll be a Christian except for this part of my life, then we're not going to be able to persevere to the end. We're not going to be able to get to heaven. That's a terrible thing. That's the worst thing that could happen. The great French writer Léon Blois said that the only tragedy is not to be a saint.
Mm-hmm.
That's the only tragedy in life, not to be a saint. We have to desire that the way those early Christians did, and we have to live for it the way those early Christians did, just in case we might have to die for it the way they did. And we don't know. In Nazi Germany, they were living a time of unprecedented peace and prosperity in Weimar Germany, and they probably never could have predicted what was coming.
Right.
The same thing on Tsarist Russia. They probably couldn't have predicted what was coming, but it came. And we should be prepared just in case it comes our way.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you just never know. I mean, there was a young girl who was sitting at her high school desk one morning when boys broke into Columbine High School with their guns.
Right.
And she had to, I wish I could remember her name, and I do her a disservice by not recalling it, but she was asked to renounce God, and she wouldn't do that, and she was killed.
Right, right. And it still happens all over, and I'm sure it happens at other times in our own country, and we don't hear about it. And there are other ways too. Many people lose their jobs because of their Christian faith. Many people are shut off from promotion at their jobs because of their Christian faith. This happens every day, and it's a quiet kind of martyrdom that is not going to get them canonized. It's not going to get the newspaper's attention. It's not going to even get them sympathy from a lot of their friends.
Or family.
Right, right. But they die a little bit every day, and we have to declare our solidarity with them, and we have to be ready to give the sacrifice that they're giving if we're called to do it.
Mm-hmm.
In reading your accounting of the Roman martyrs, and the thing that really sustained those early Christians, again, they didn't have scripture. They didn't have a book called the Bible. They had the readings that they would have, the proclaimed during their gatherings, but what they had, in its essence, was the Eucharist.
You know, last year on the Feast of the Roman Martyrs, I was in Rome, and it was a real privilege to be there. And I gave a talk that's there on my website, fathersofthechurch.com, so people can download it in audio if they want to. But I gave a talk on the Roman Martyrs on their feast day. But what was interesting is that in the days leading up to that, we were visiting all of these sites from the early church, all of the sites where the martyrs were buried, in the catacombs and in the lower levels of some of the churches that are still standing from the early centuries of the church. And what you find decorating the tombs of these early martyrs over and over again are Eucharistic images. They're the images of sheaves of wheat and clusters of grapes. There are loaves of bread everywhere. And you find this again and again, that the early Christians were equating this act of the Eucharist with the act of martyrdom. I told you Pope Benedict has written somewhat extensively on the subject. There's actually a book that came out from a scholar at Notre Dame, and it's one of my favorite books. It's just a little book, and it's called In Procession Before the World. It's Martyrdom as Public Liturgy in Early Christianity. And the early Christians understood it this way. The Mass is our private liturgy, because in those days, only Christians were admitted to the Mass, and only people who could receive communion were able to stay until communion.
Mm-hmm.
If you were not baptized, you were turned out after the liturgy of the Word.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the private liturgy. But they looked upon martyrdom as the public liturgy. That's what happened in public, where everyone could see it. That's where they could see people, men and women, transubstantiated into the body and blood of Christ, perfect in their imitation of Christ, becoming that new man that Jesus Christ was. And they saw this in the arena as these people were ground by the teeth of lions. Ignatius of Antioch was so looking forward to this when he wrote to the Romans that he said, you know, don't hinder them. Don't hinder them. Let them take me into the arena where I'll be ground like wheat in the teeth of the lions so that I can become the pure bread of Christ. Mm. And again, this is the same Ignatius who earlier I mentioned said he would be poured out like a libation. So Ignatius is bread and Ignatius is wine. He saw his life as the mass he was offering. And for him, that was a very dramatic moment of martyrdom. But again, for us, it might be a daily kind of martyrdom where we're misunderstood by our friends or our neighbors or our coworkers. We're misunderstood by them. We're despised by them for our faith. But we have to just continue witnessing to it in love and in kindness so that they'll come around eventually. The great miracle is that that crazy Rome, that perverted Rome, that depraved Rome, where Nero reigned for so many years in such a sick way, with the support of many people who were sharing his lifestyle, Rome converted, and it became a Christian city.
How about
not
that?
Not only that, but it became the ultimate Christian city on earth. This is the great miracle. It's like a transubstantiation of that city.
Yeah.
Now, how did that happen? It happened because of the Mass and because of the martyrs, this witness of the martyrs under the altar, as we see in the book of Revelation. And it can happen today. It can happen in our country. It can happen to the world. And that's what Jesus willed when he established the Mass.
And you can really get a sense in our own lifetime how that transformation occurred at that pinnacle moment at John Paul the Great's funeral.
Oh, yes.
When all eyes were on Rome. But look at it, and even in his martyrdom, really. I mean, in whether those who feel it was a different type, but his example.
Oh, sure.
Really, it connects us to those early Christians 2,000 years ago.
There is no doubt in my mind that that was the reason for the public spectacle of his suffering. You know, if you saw him on television struggling to get words out, that's a humiliating experience for anyone who's had to endure it, anyone who's endured a stroke, you know, stroke survivors, to have to try to speak that way.
Mm-hmm.
But to do it when all the cameras are watching, to sit there unable to control your drooling on international television, and not only that, but traveling around the world and witnessing this way. He lived this public liturgy of a kind of martyrdom, as you say, you know, for all the world to see. And in his case, you know, he so much of his decline in health, you know, the would-be assassin's bullet so many years earlier, that marked a kind of beginning of a decline in his health. So there is a sort of martyrdom involved there.
Right. Well, as you point out, I mean, if martyrdom is indeed a total gift of self, then there are any number of ways that in martyrdom we can give ourselves back to Jesus.
Absolutely. And so much of it is just, as I said before, the kind of martyrdom that no one's going to notice. It's giving up our preferences so that our family will be a little bit happier, saying, you know, I'd rather go where you want to go, and just constantly dying to self that way and giving in to the preferences of the others in the family. It begins at home. It always begins at home. And from there, it spreads out to the neighborhood and to the coworkers to give up our peeves and our preferences and all of the things that place us at the center of the universe, and to put others at that center there with Jesus Christ, and to serve Jesus Christ in them. Once we're doing that, then we're transforming the world.
And again, I just think this continually points towards the Eucharist, because in their ability to be able to witness to us, whether it is a John Paul or a Mother Teresa or the martyrs of Rome, what gave them the courage, we may not be able to see it, but you can see the effects of it, the grace.
Oh, yes. And it's still resonating to this day. And they're still interceding for us to this day. The great thing, you know, as you pointed out before, is it's not just a memorial. Cardinal Newman had this great line where he said, everyone who ever lived is still alive today.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something that we have to keep in mind, that these people are not only still alive, but they're aware of us. and we can get to know them. You know, we look at these celebrities and the tabloids, you know, and that sort of thing, and they're all so distant,
mm-hmm.
and
yep.
they live these lives on a stage, and people read the tabloids and say, well, I could never get to know that person. I could never run in that social circle. But when we talk about these saints, these great saints of the early church, we can spend time in their company. We can get to know them. We can talk with them. We can ask their intercession. And these are the real rich and famous in the supernatural order.
Mm-hmm.
And we can invoke their power before the throne of God. And this is a great, great thing that God has given us in giving us the communion of saints, giving us all this community that stretches out not only across the, all over the world, but across all the ages, well into the past. They're immediately present to us.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I got a sense of that even today that, Mike, there are times when I will go to a daily Mass.
Yes.
And there are those people, those wonderful men and women who go every day, have gone every day for the last 65 years.
Right.
And in them, it's like touching heaven a little bit.
It really is. And it's a quiet witness.
Mm-hmm.
A quiet witness. I have that same experience because I look around and I see those people. In the mornings on a weekday, and it's quiet, it's kind of dark in the church. They don't turn all the lights on
mm-hmm.
like they do on Sundays, but it's a little dim, and it's early in the morning, and you're looking around, and so many of them are so old, and yet they're the ones who are running all the charitable activity in my hometown.
Mm-hmm.
They're the ones who are running Meals on Wheels. They're retired. They have a little bit more time. They're running the St. Vincent de Paul Society, the clothing drives. They're running the food bank in our town, and it's a wonderful thing to behold. It really is. And you see that tradition of charity that began in the apostolic age continues today. I know I've quoted it on this show before, but I never get tired of quoting it. It's from one of the early liturgical documents where it gives clear instructions on how everyone's to behave at Mass. It's from the Didascalia Apostolorum, and there's a great line in there, and it said, "Widows and orphans are to be revered like the altar." Widows and orphans are to be revered like the altar.
Mm.
And again, widows and orphans were at the bottom of that society. You know, they were the poorest of the poor. They had no one to take care of them. And yet, they were to be looked upon as something that was the greatest thing on earth, the altar of sacrifice. And it was that Eucharistic participation that gave people the added oomph to live out charitably and sacrificially in their everyday. That's the kind of culture we want to build, where widows and orphans, the poorest of the poor, are revered like the altar. Often today, that's going to be immigrants.
Well, mm-hmm. I was just starting to get teary when you were talking about that, because I do. I see that as the opportunity we have as Christians to really live that out, because we do have those poor amongst us, and the culture is screaming at us,
yes.
You're out of here. You do not belong here. You did not come here the right way.
Right.
And I know that there are many feelings on that, but ultimately, it comes down to what would Christ have us do?
Right, right. And even if we do, want to nuance our position so that we're limiting immigration or anything like that, we have to watch our rhetoric. We
right.
really have to watch it. And it pains me to see sometimes prominent Christians speaking with a rhetoric of hatred and almost talking about these immigrants who are mostly coming from Catholic countries and who are Catholics as somehow subhuman.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And again, these I always think of it as these are my ancestors going to Ellis Island because my ancestors were unlettered Sicilians who were coming over here,
mm-hmm.
peasants from little villages in Sicily, and they had nothing when they were arriving. And then you had people on this side of the country like Margaret Sanger.
Mm-hmm.
We're saying that they should all be sterilized
yes.
because they were a criminal element, dark people. So
we forget that past, don't we?
Very quickly.
Yeah, it's crazy.
And, anytime we've ever talked about it, I have to think, as I begin to form my own ideas and my own opinions, that for those who I truly love and who so many admire, if John Paul were sitting here, Mother Teresa were sitting right here, right now, what would they tell us? What would they say to us? They would say to us what Christ would say, welcome the stranger, feed
right.
the hungry,
mm-hmm.
clothe the naked.
Right, and what Pope Benedict said in his encyclical, God is Love,
it's
fairly clear.
Right. Well, and the baseline here, especially for us as Catholics, is that we are a Eucharistic people.
Mm-hmm.
And to borrow a line from the documents that we have here from you, St. Irenaeus put it, our way of thinking is attuned to the Eucharist, and the Eucharist in turn confirms our way of thinking.
Right.
And I think going forward, that really helps us in the marketplace, day-to-day, with day-to-day living, that shows people that we mean what we say and we mean what we take in. You know, we are Eucharistic.
Right, and that's what those first Roman martyrs, that's how they lived. That's how they lived every day, not just their last day.
Right.
Every day they lived before that was a preparation for that last day, and it was a day of self-giving, not getting for self, but giving for others.
Right, total gift of self.
And I would say to anyone who struggles with the positions of the church or hears this message and it seems so counter-cultural or what you would want immediately in your heart as a solution, is that you have to go to the summit that fed and gave the grace enough for these people that would die. You need to go to the Eucharist and take your doubts, take your concerns, and take it to Christ in the Eucharist.
Because God doesn't ask us to do the impossible, and He will give us the grace that's sufficient to carry us through. We have that promise.
Exactly. Well, Mike, thank you so much for sharing with us on the early Roman martyrs and so much more. It's always a pleasure to have you here on the program, and we look forward to having you back again sometime soon.
Well, I'm looking forward to that day. If anyone wants to listen to my talk on the Roman martyrs today, again, it's on my blog at fathersofthechurch.com.
And don't forget, too, the St. Paul Center for Biblical Theology, an awesome website there, too, at salvationhistory.com.
And you should. Any library, in your home library or parish library, should have a copy of The Mass of the Early Christians.
Oh. Yep.
Even Bob Lockwood said that's the must-have book.
That's right.
And he's right.
Well, Bob was the guy who got me to write it, so he should know.
Okay.
All right. Mike, thanks so much. God bless.
Take care.